With Sarah Pauley, who is most recently the writer and director of Take This Waltz. Sarah, how are you doing?
Really good. How are you?
Good to be here. Anyway, let's go straight to the chase. I have very little time and lots of questions. So there is a line that Fiona says in the car in Away From Her. I think people are too demanding. People want to be in love every single day. What a liability. So Take This Waltz almost carries on with the extension of this idea of the need for daily sweeping romance. But, you know, this film, it's almost the complete opposite of, say, a movie like Brief Encounter, where, you know, you suggest in this case that Margot's adulterous desires are sort of selfish and childish, the I love you at the very end of the movie. So I'm wondering, do you see your two films as writer and director as sort of corrective responses to this notion of romance? And how do you feel independent cinema is doing in depicting this more pernicious side of the adulterous desire? Just to start out here.
Wow, that was amazing. I feel like, I do feel like Away From Her and Take This Waltz are companion pieces to a certain extent, even though they're completely different films. I do think they are talking about the same thing in very different ways. I think that, that line that Fiona says of, you know, people want to be in love every single day. What a liability. People are too demanding. I do actually feel that. I feel like we have unrealistic expectations of our relationships, that they're going to fulfill us at every moment. And if they don't, there must be something wrong with them.
Yeah.
And we better go out and solve that. But I sort of think that that's a cultural thing and that we have that notion in almost every aspect of our lives. I think that we're a culture that's incredibly uncomfortable with emptiness, with feeling like life has a gap in it, with feeling like things aren't perfect. And so we feel that if there's something missing, that automatically means there's something wrong and we need to go out and fix it. We just need to make the right move in our lives and everything will somehow feel complete. And I think we constantly get kind of shocked and blindsided by the fact that I think that feeling of something missing and that emptiness does kind of follow us around a little bit.
Yeah.
Or at least for periods of time. I do feel it's funny that you brought up that line because, like, I never really thought of the connection between that line and Take This Waltz. But I do actually think Take This Waltz is an extension of that.
Yeah.
Of that a little bit. And at the same time, I think I probably started writing the script a lot more judgmentally of the main character, Margot, than I ended up.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up feeling by the end of making the film that I empathized with all three characters and that there were no heroes and villains. And
interesting.
While some of her choices seem immature or childish or self-involved, I think that enough people are connecting to her as a character and feeling quite defensive of her that it's making me see her a lot more sympathetically as well.
It's interesting that in both movies, you keep that transgressive moment, and I don't want to spoil either film, to the last possible minute. I think it's like in the last 10 minutes in the first film, and in this, it's perhaps the last 20, 25. And I'm wondering about sustaining that need to transgress from this seemingly stable relationship of some years, too, by the way. It's interesting that both marriages, one, the first is 44 years, the second is like 4 or 5 years. So I'm wondering, you know, are you more interested in that period before one transgresses within this way of sort of looking at these long-form relationships and this issue? Or?
I think it's the most cinematic part of a relationship like that is before something actually happens.
Yes.
I think that in a way all the deliciousness of that kind of relationship happens before anything happens. So it was important to me in this film that Margot not be someone who takes this lightly. Like, she is someone who really deeply loves her husband. She is extremely tempted and extremely brought to life by this other person, but she's not someone who's easily going to betray her husband or leave her husband, and that it's really difficult for her. And in fact, that makes that other situation even more tempting and even more alive.
Yes. I also wanted to ask you about the house, which intrigued me in a number of ways. First of all, we see the kitchen obsession that was in the first one repeats in this one, which I thought was actually quite interesting. But there is this interesting notion of Margot almost seeking the real space while also seeking the fantastical space. Because you see this moment where they're both watching TV in this cramped office, which as a freelancer I can totally relate to. In fact, the way we watch TV in our house is quite similar to that. But you also then see the scale of where she goes open up over the course of the film. It starts with the pool, and then later on we have the loft. And I'm wondering, you know, because their space is not exactly... I mean, I buy certain rooms. Yes, that's exactly how a struggling freelancer writer or even a successful freelance writer would probably have that kind of space. But on the other hand, well, that kitchen is rather large, even if you are a fairly moderately successful cookbook author. So I'm curious about, you know, how you design the space with this tension between the real and the phantasmagorical or the fantastical in mind.
Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting question because, so downtown Toronto,
yes,
up until about 10 or 15 years ago, in the area where these characters live.
Kensington Market, right?
It's sort of Little Portugal, Little Italy. Yeah, yeah. Like 10 years ago, you know, when Margot and Lou would have bought that house, when it was still, primarily like a community of families,
yeah,
and, you know, generations of families, would have actually been, you know, affordable with,
yeah,
a considerable amount of debt to... you know, two fairly bohemian people.
Yeah.
I have friends who bought houses then with absolutely no money, with, you know, with a loan, and just, you know, maybe didn't do renovations for years and years and years, and it fell apart a little bit. But that actually would realistically be a house they could have bought.
Uh-huh.
There's no way those two characters could buy that house now.
Of course.
So,
yeah,
like, you know, if the film was like taking place 10 years from now, there's no way you would believe it.
Comparable to Brooklyn,
yeah,
actually.
And the truth is, like, you know, they probably realistically at this point in 2 years' time would have figured out the value of their house and sold it and, like, made a lot of money. But yeah, it's like, I think culturally it's a weird thing in Toronto where, you know, there have been traditionally these downtown neighborhoods right in the urban core with, like, pretty lovely, you know, maybe rundown Victorian and Edwardian houses,
yeah,
that were fairly affordable.
Yeah.
That's changed and
sure,
is changing. And that's really sad because it means the demographics of who lives downtown is really changing as well.
So you have given this some thought.
I have given it some thought because it is something that I noticed, like, doesn't quite translate. Like, in every other country, people are like, those people could never afford that,
yeah,
house. And I want to go, you're right now, but what was amazing 10 years ago in Toronto is people like them could.
It's like Kubrick sneering at Woody Allen for saying, there's no way these people could live in these spacious apartments in New York. You know,
no,
like,
exactly.
That sort of similar thing.
Exactly. And I feel like, you know, then it does get fantastical, though,
yeah,
to be fair.
Of course.
I feel like then when we go to, you know, where they live in the end in this,
yeah,
giant loft space,
yes,
then I think we do take it into the realm of fantasy a little bit. Although I feel like the way we sort of designed that was as though it was like an abandoned, you know, loft on top of a building, which, again, I think those spaces were much more readily available 10 years ago than they are now. But,
well, this leads me to ask, I mean, the ending, and it's hard to discuss without giving it away, so I'm going to do my best, but that notion of the fantastical that enters into it. When I watched this, I thought to myself, because I was so... God, you tested my morals. I was like, don't do it, but, you know, I'm not going to say what happens, but when she is in that loft... And thanks for the equal opportunity in terms of what happened. I appreciate that little touch. But you know, I thought that the movie had immediately transformed into a fantasy, and then it goes back into the real. And I'm wondering if at any point during the devising of this story, if you actually did think that it was going to be more of this sort of whimsy into the fantasy, or were you really rooted upon... I mean, were you forced to combat certain feelings to the impulse to turn it into a fantasy at any point, or...
No, but I did want that sequence that you're talking about, where
yes,
you know, we can say it's a 360,
yeah,
degree, you know, shot that shows the progression of a sexual relationship basically,
yeah,
in one shot. And there is something fantastical about that, and,
yeah,
I didn't shy away from that. Like, there's something contrived about it. There's something strange and fantastical about it, and it is to kind of show the passing of time,
absolutely,
in one long shot. And that was one of the first images I ever had for the film. So in a way, like, it's out of place in the film. It sort of all of a sudden breaks with the tone and the reality of the film. But I felt like that somehow I could get away with it. And people disagree on that.
Yeah.
Some people think I did get away with it, and some people really like it.
I appreciated being tested. But there's actually a prototype for that 360 shot in Away From Her, because there's one,
yeah,
there near the end. And there's even a moment I saw when this chair is being turned into a circle. So obviously, I'm wondering the cyclical nature of this film. Did you design it out of order? Did you write certain scenes before other ones? How did this come about?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of ideas came out of order. So a lot of,
yeah,
the interactions between Margot and Daniel sort of came to me, and then sort of figuring out, you know, what happened in between those scenes became a little bit of the work of the film. And then I think it was also this idea of having a woman at the beginning of the film and at the end of the film in the same kind of basically content space, but also feeling there was something really missing, and figuring out how she could begin and end in basically the same place, but have totally upended her life in between to get there.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about the way that the two husbands react in both of these films. What was striking to me, and this could very well just be American versus Canadian, but I do want to press you on this, is that some serious emotional shit happens to both of them. Stuff that is just, you know, they're surprisingly calm and collected under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. A lot of men in that situation would just completely wither up or break down or just explode. But you actually opted to have these men both react very calmly to very viscerally distressing events. And I'm wondering, you know, why you did that. Is this a reflection of either, you know, Canadianism, or is this a reflection that no matter what you go through in life, you will still have the capacity to be a reasonable person at best? What of this?
I think that's a really interesting question. I've never really noticed that before. But I feel like, you know, I could have all kinds of ideas about why I did that. But the truth is, I think those things are subconscious.
Yeah,
and I
course.
Feel a little bit, when you ask me that question, I immediately think of my dad. So,
yeah.
You know, why do you do things as a filmmaker without examining them? So I did, you know, in both films, the man who's, you know, betrayed reacts like very calmly and maturely in some sense, and with a lot of wisdom and grace. Yeah. And you think, well, maybe those are my choices of the character. But the truth is, like, probably all the choices we make subconsciously as artists are deeply rooted in childhood. And I think my dad's like that. I think I come from
a very calm
father
family.
Who is, it's not a calm family, but my dad has a very different orientation to emotions like anger or jealousy, or there's no possessiveness about him. There's no sort of, and he's somebody who I think maybe one occasion in my life has seen actually exhibit anger.
Yeah.
So I feel like maybe that's just more interesting to me, and maybe it's more familiar to me to see a man deal with those kinds of emotions in an incredibly graceful, mature way, because I think that's, you know, so, you know, it's funny, like I have all kinds of ideas of why that is more interesting to watch on film, you know, than histrionics. But I think ultimately it's probably just what my original experiences of a man dealing with difficult emotions are, is that they're good at it.
Yes.
Which is probably pretty privileged, but
I'm curious about, you know, you have both movies dealing with marriage, as I said, you know, very long marriage. And I'm wondering, you know, I know you're married now. I'm guessing you weren't married when this movie was made, but I'm wondering how your views on marriage have changed between the two films. And I'm also wondering, because, you know, I know your biography, and I know you've lived probably more lives than most people who are your age. And I'm wondering if taking the long view, whether it be looking at a long relationship or, you know, pining in this case for the lighthouse after in 40 years to go ahead and meet up with this handsome stranger, 2040 rather, where does that come from? This guy, are you a sort of a long view minded person more than a short view, or are you always trying to find some kind of examination of humanity that just really takes into account something that isn't so ephemeral, something that isn't so superficial? What's up with this?
I don't know. I think it's really interesting. I feel like when you phrase it that way, it makes me really concerned that in 25 years or 30 years, I'm going to look back on the films I made about long-term relationships and marriage when I was in my 20s and 30s as laughable and, like, incredibly superficial and naive, you know, because ultimately you must just get to know more and more, and probably it's a bad idea to make films about these things when you're, you know, when you're young. I don't know.
But a lot of young filmmakers, they generally make very superficial relationships, or even young relationships. Let's just say young relationships. They point to some magical affair or something like that, not these long commitments as you do. It's almost like you're doing things in reverse, I would say.
Well, I guess I'm really interested in what happens when people really get to know each other, because we're so imperfect, and it's so hard as a flawed human being to make yourself compatible and to live with another flawed human being. It's a real mystery to me how that ever works, and yet it does. And I think it's where a lot of the greatest joy comes in life, but certainly it's where I think most of the intense complications can come from.
Yeah.
You know, if you have food and shelter and life is basically comfortable, I think this is like our main source of tension and conflict. So, and joy. So I think it's just, for me, the most obvious way to get at being human is to talk about what happens to people when they really know each other well.
Yeah. In terms of acting, which you've been doing less of years, is it really a matter of just not wanting to repeat yourself? Or do you find that moving into the director's chair and the screenwriting chair is of greater fulfillment towards understanding, you know, how you grapple with humanity, how you grapple with your place, whether it be winter in the first film or summer in this film, or I'm looking forward to the other two seasons and two more movies of yours.
I feel like it's strange because I feel like I love acting, but writing and directing just takes up more time. So just by default, you act less. I love acting, but I also feel like I need to get braver. I need to get better. I need to challenge myself more. I need to stop using the same tricks I've always used. I'm sort of tired of myself as an actor. So I feel like I really want to look for projects that I can really force myself to do something really different. And in the interim, I just feel like I'm always so consumed with whatever film I'm making myself that there seems to be very little time left over to act. So I hope to keep doing it, but I think just by default, I'll probably do it less than making my own films.
In Take This Waltz, I noticed a greater interest in metaphors, I think. This may have something to do with the fact that you were creating a brand new story as opposed to relying upon Alice Munro. But I am curious about this because we see, for example, like, you know, literally a naked conversation, the circles I was mentioning earlier, pissing in the pool. Of course, the ultimate, the amusement park ride, which is a great metaphor for what an affair might be. I mean, the lights go on, it's all excitement, and then they turn off suddenly, and of course, video killed the radio star. I'm wondering, you know, if this reliance on more hard visual metaphors is an effort on your part either to evolve your visual style, or is it an effort to really kind of grapple with film? It's more of a visual medium, that you want to just inhabit that visual sphere, and that metaphors are the best way of doing this, and also really realizing these relationships on film.
Yeah, I think it's not that conscious a choice, mm-hmm. but I think that there were a lot of moments that I wanted to create between specifically Margot and Daniel that were physical and were visual and without words, that a lot can't be realized between them without it being a betrayal. So in fact, words themselves can be a betrayal, and they are at times in the film. So I felt like I wanted to create as many opportunities as possible for them to have interactions that were about images and about looks as opposed to words. And that meant a lot of silent scenes that were purely visual. And those were my greatest joy in making the film, were you know, those visual experiments that I hadn't had before, done before. So yeah.
Using heavyweight comic actors instead of heavyweight dramatic actors this time. You had, you know, Julie Christie, Olympia Dukakis in the first film, and you have in this film Seth Rogen and Sarah Silverman. Was that also an effort to shake things up in terms of, you know, getting out of the style?
It wasn't like a conscious choice. It was just Seth was who I had always thought of when I was writing the script. He was always the anchor I wanted to create the film around. And Sarah Silverman is, I've just been such a huge fan of hers for so long, and I knew that she would have an amazing dramatic performance in her, and sort of ended up writing the part for her in the last draft. So,
okay. I do not want to totally disrupt your schedule, but Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank
it was a pleasure
so
to
much.
Chat.
Thank
Hopefully
you so much. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Really nice to see you.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.